For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited that our program today can be devoted entirely to the fine arts, with part one of today's program devoted to this weekend's performance by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, Saturday evening, a concert devoted to all American music with kind of a jazz flavor with some of it, and with a superb concert pianist as the special guest, whom we'll be meeting a little later, right after talking with Maestro Bob Hasty, artistic director for the Kenosha Symphony. A little later in the hour, we'll be previewing a play that is about to open at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. So we have a busy day, and we begin with Maestro Bob Hasty, who is on the podium for the Kenosha Symphony for Saturday night's concert at 7:30 at Ruther High School. Professor Hasty, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and good to see you and talk to you, Greg.
And I'm excited to talk about Saturday night's concert and the wonderful repertoire that is lined up there. It's obviously a program designed to entertain one and all. First, though, just say a quick word about what it has been like for you and the Kenosha Symphony, and for that matter, also what you do down at Northwestern University in terms of emerging slowly but surely from the sadness of the COVID-19 pandemic, which by no means is over, but of course, life is much different than it was certainly 6 months ago or 12 months ago or 18 months ago. What has this time been like for you, and what does it feel like now to be inching ever closer to something a little more like normalcy?
Well, obviously, when we talk about surviving this pandemic in the arts, most people use the word challenging, but I would love to be able to illuminate some of the joys that have, and some of the innovations that have come out of this, how we've been able to still deliver music. Speaking specifically about the Kenosha Symphony, you and I were actually working together to produce a Broadway-themed concert. And it was going to be that Saturday after the lockdown happened on Thursday. So that was when we simply went through cancellations. But the next year, with the help of the board, we considered ways of delivering music in a safe way. So the easiest way to describe it is that we focused on string orchestra music, which for me as a violinist and as somebody who considers all of the facets of orchestral composition, string orchestra music is a really important part. So it was a really great opportunity for me and the members of the Kenosha Symphony to do just string orchestra music. It allowed us also, to do some, for instance, Samuel Coleridge Taylor's novelettes last year, which during a normal Kenosha Symphony Orchestra season, we probably would not be doing string orchestra music because the audiences want to hear a symphony orchestra. We're actually called the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. So we featured string orchestra music. That way, everybody could have masks on. And the audience could have masks on. We had smaller audiences over at the Kemper Center. And we were able to live stream the concerts, and they're still available. And we had as many as 300 people tune in to the live stream with multiple cameras. And it was just very, very beautiful. And it was very heartwarming. That first concert, I will always remember because it was the first time of performing after the incidents that happened up in Kenosha. And so we were able to do some beautiful tributes and respond musically in that way. So for me, when I think about that year, yes, we missed having our woodwind players and brass players. We missed them very, very much. It would have been great had we learned how to do more symphonic repertoire that we could involve them in some way, but it was simply impossible, especially with regards to the space and logistics and safety. So we would have small audiences, but we would have huge audiences online. So I'm very proud of the way that we navigated the music.
It's a very good reason. You have a lot to be proud of, that's for sure. And it's interesting.
Go ahead.
And it's interesting to think about, as you've already touched on, some of the innovations, some of the new ideas, new ways of doing old, familiar things that will probably stay with us for a long time. Thanks to the unhappiness of COVID, there at least have been things that have emerged. I know at where you teach, where I teach, and in all kinds of performing arts venues, life is different. And in some ways, oddly enough, surprisingly enough, maybe is for the better now. Thanks.
Yeah, we learned things that we'll probably keep. And although there are certain things that we are glad to have back, such as our wind section. So during the summer, we performed outside and we started doing smaller works in the fall by Mozart and Beethoven, and then bigger concert in December. And this is our first full symphonic concert since the pandemic began. And so it'll be large forces, and it'll be even larger in May, a larger string section when we do Brahms and Tchaikovsky. As far as Northwestern, you mentioned both of us being in academia. That was probably the challenging one, was to find out. So for instance, at Northwestern University, 2 weeks before orchestras were to resume, and we were going to do string orchestra stuff, then we were told freshmen and sophomores weren't even going to be allowed to be on campus. So within about a week or two, I had to create an orchestra class that was fully online. And then we also did string orchestra works with the students who were on campus, but we also had to serve students who elected to be off campus. So we had remote ensembles where we would do things like excerpts. One of the cool things about Zoom is that you can have guests appear to your class who normally would not be able to because they live thousands of miles away. So we had a friend of mine who's the concertmaster of the White House Marines own orchestra, and he was able to speak to my students. I was able to have people talk about auditioning for professional orchestras. I was able to have Rachel Barton Pine come in and talk about Black composers. And so we were able to do things and learn a lot of things in depth. And then we also focused, once we did get back to in-person string orchestra music, we were able to use a software such as Panopto to webcast the concerts. It was kind of funny because we couldn't have audiences. So we just, during class, in the middle of class, I had them all wear black, and then we performed the concert, and some of us would dress nicely. We had our violin faculty, Desiree Rustrat, perform all four of the Piazzolla seasons of Buenos Aires. And so we still treated it like a concert, but it was still really weird to not hear applause. So we got used to clapping for ourselves, because we're saying, you know, our attitude is we're performing for each other and we are going to appreciate each other. And so that was a wonderful way of navigating through it. And some of my best memories are going to be from that time of how we were able to collaborate and navigate successfully in new ways and in memorable ways through the pandemic and keep music going.
Well said. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking in part one of today's morning show with Bob Hasty, who is on the music faculty at Northwestern University down in Evanston, but also now for many years, the artistic director of the Kenosha Symphony. For how many years now?
I think I started in 2012, so this would be about 10. I guess this would be 10.
Well, happy anniversary. And so this concert coming up Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. in the Ralph Houghton Auditorium at Reuther High School is called Jazzy American Moods. And it's going to feature four works that are all great crowd pleasers. The overture to Leonard Bernstein's Candide, Morton Gould's American Salute. I think that's the thing that's with Johnny Come Marching Home again. Wonderful, entertaining. And Aaron Copland's ballet set in the Old West, Rodeo, and Gershwin's Concerto in F, his three-movement piano concerto, which many regard as among his greatest masterworks, maybe his greatest masterwork, despite it not having a particularly flashy title, but it is an incredibly marvelous piece of music. We don't have a ton of time, unfortunately, to kind of dig through all of these pieces, and we'll be talking with the pianist Winston Choi in just a few minutes, but what would you like to say about putting together this particular program, choosing this repertoire, and the challenges that they present to the orchestra?
Well, the great opportunity here is to do American composers, to present those with the Kenosha Symphony. Not something that we get to do very often because most people want to hear the greatest hits. They want to hear the Brahms symphonies. They want to hear the Beethoven symphonies, and we certainly do those. But there are some staples of the American repertoire, which we should be very, very proud of, most notably Aaron Copland. So that is going to be the culmination of this piece and one of his more famous ballets, his second cowboy ballet that he did. And so right after Billy the Kid, he wrote this music called, we call it Rodeo, and maybe somebody can figure out why we call it that instead of rodeo. But just so that your listeners know, it's actually rodeo. It's spelled that way, even though we kind of say rodeo. But it is it has a lot of familiarity with concert public, and we are very, very proud to bring that. The other pieces are also staples of American repertoire. Obviously, Leonard Bernstein, who's most recently coming off of the Spielberg version of West Side Story, so we're getting reacquainted with him. But this particular overture is the most often performed concert piece of Leonard Bernstein. So, I mean, you could talk about musicals and everything, but in terms of concert piece, this is the most frequently performed, and it was kind of funny. I joked with the orchestra the other night that whenever I do it with youth orchestras, which is where most of us played it, I refer to it as, and this also has the theme to the Dick Cavett Show. And most of my younger students look back at me and go, who's that? And so luckily with adults who are my age, they are familiar with that as well. Morton Gould, When Johnny Comes Marching Home, that was written during World War II. He wrote it for government, a radio broadcast using a Civil War tune to as inspiration for this. But what's really interesting is that he started writing it at 6 o'clock p.m. The copyists were ready to go at 2 a.m. so that the orchestra could rehearse in the morning, the next morning, and then it was broadcast on radio the next night. So
wow.
All within 24 hours, he wrote it. It was copied, rehearsed, and then performed. But the one piece that I was really excited to do, I'm excited to do all of them, is the piece by George Gershwin. Your audience will know, Rhapsody in Blue. Is this something like Rhapsody in Blue, which was done first? Rhapsody in Blue was the commissioner heard Rhapsody in Blue and said, I would like to commission a concerto. This one is a traditional concerto with three movements, unlike Rhapsody in Blue. And also, unlike Rhapsody in Blue, which we all associate as Gershwin's more famous, one of his most famous works, is that he actually didn't orchestrate Rhapsody in Blue. That was actually orchestrated by Ferdy Groffay, who many of us know wrote the Grand Canyon Suite, which had a lot of the tunes that I remember from cartoons, you know, the donkey going down the hill, you know, this, and he actually orchestrated it. But for this concerto, Gershwin did it all. So this is actually Gershwin's orchestration. Certainly it's got jazz, it's got vaudeville themes in the third movement, and certainly influenced. You definitely hear Gershwin, even though he originally thought it should be called a New York concerto. But when you hear it, you hear Hollywood. You hear Hollywood, you hear jazz, and just a wonderful opportunity to do this again. And it's so great to be able to work with Winston Choi. Winston and I have collaborated at least three times before, but we've always done, I'm trying to think, we've done a Mozart piano concerto. He and I have done the Beethoven triple concerto along with his wife, Minghuan Chu, on that one. And he and his wife, Minghuan, have already performed with the Kenosha Symphony. I'd say about 6 or 7 years ago, we did the Mendelssohn D minor. So the double concerto. And but this is one of the first 20th century pieces I've been able to collaborate with him. And he's also somebody who I called quickly because we had a cancellation. And so Winston has only been on the program for the past couple of months. And so we had a cancellation. Somebody else was going to be performing this. And then we contacted Winston. He said, yeah, I'll play this. And wow. So this isn't the first time we've had a cancellation with the Kenosha Symphony, but I'm very grateful that I have a list of musicians that I've worked with before who would be able to step up and sit down and play the piano. And I think we're going to be really excited for Winston to join us this weekend.
Fantastic. Well, speaking of him joining us, I'm about to speak with him and look forward to hearing a little more about his wide-ranging career and about this opportunity that we all have to hear him play with the Kenosha Symphony, this magnificent concerto in F by George Gershwin. And you've set the stage really, really well, Maestro. Bob Hasty, the artistic director of the Kenosha Symphony, thank you so much for making time for this conversation. And I am very, very excited to see the concert Saturday night. I know a lot of other people are as well. Best wishes
thank
to you.
Thank you, Greg. I'm looking forward to seeing a nice audience this year on Saturday for our first symphonic presentation since everything happened.
Excellent.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And now we get to speak to that concert pianist that Maestro Bob Hasty was speaking about so enthusiastically and with good reason, Dr. Winston Choi, who is Associate Professor of Piano, Director of Piano Studies at Roosevelt University in Chicago, and someone who has done all kinds of remarkable music making, embracing a wide array of repertoire, including lots and lots of modern music. And Winston Choi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Pleasure to speak with you.
I appreciate you making time in what I know is a busy schedule for us to have this conversation. I read in your biography that you are actually Canadian, and I would love to know at least briefly about your earliest experiences with music and what ultimately drew you to the piano.
Sure. I had perhaps a slightly different musical upbringing compared to some of my peers in the sense that I had no family influences. My parents had no classical music background. And when I first started, I had this wonderful teacher who has now passed away, Vivian Bailey. She encouraged me from the very beginning to write my own music as a six-year-old. So I was composing before I really even knew how to write.
Wow.
Even in English. So I was just kind of making up tunes all the time, listening to recordings and trying to transcribe it before I knew the notation of it. And so that's I feel like it was a very creative and interesting start to my piano studies. And then, of course, then became more traditional after that. But it's really just a lot of self-exploration and kind of figuring things out on my own through trial and error.
Interesting. I love that story. I'm just curious, through the course of your life, was music and piano always kind of the predominant theme, or were there certain moments in time where suddenly it was baseball or video games or something else that kind of drew your attention and energy, or not so much? Has this been largely an unbroken arc for you and a very soul focus?
Yeah, it's been pretty steady, unbroken. Maybe I wavered ever so slightly in my high school years. Not necessarily waving away from piano, but finding more interests, other things pulling at me. But ultimately, it still truly was piano at the forefront of all of my, you know, my upbringing, and it's been central to my life.
At what point did it become clear that it is something you were going to want to do with your life, in a sense, vocationally, that this was, in a sense, or you hoped at least, that it might become sort of your professional destination?
I think there was a stretch within high school when I started to feel like the amount of time that I was spending, not that I knew exactly what the profession was going to bring to me, but it felt like this was something that I was going to dedicate the rest of my life to. That I already knew. I think my teachers were talking to me in that kind of a way, and it started to kind of lay itself out for me, not the specifics of what I was going to do. But in terms of my commitment to it, it didn't really ever feel like it was that much work. It was just my passion, what I longed to do, and I had the chance to do it all day.
Hmm. You have done a tremendous amount of more modern music, and of course, right from the outset, have been even creating your own music. So obviously, there is a very sort of special passion there. So how would you characterize your relationship with the more standard repertoire? I mean, for instance, when you sit down and play Brahms, how does that feel to you? What kind of satisfaction and experience does that give you versus when you sit down and are playing something by Ligeti or something by yourself something that has just been composed? Are they very different experiences for you, and is one, in a sense, significantly above the other?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wouldn't say I'd necessarily put one over the other, although there are many, many similarities in terms of how I approach both composers, because I want to do my absolute best to honor the composer's intentions while kind of offering my own viewpoint on the music, and that I think is the same regardless of whom the composer is. So to really get to understand a composer's style by listening to other pieces that they wrote, even outside of piano, and bringing as much of that as possible into my solo piano playing. But secondly, I would say aesthetically, of course, there are some differences, but the differences are just as great, let's say, between Bach and Debussy. There's so much, the aesthetic differences and you know, how different their worlds were are just as different as, you know, the Romantic era till now. So in a sense, every era, every composer, every period within history has such a completely different set of things pulling at it, different contexts. So I try as much as I can to I would say, embrace a certain kind of continuum that exists within all music, yet at the same time, try to find what is distinct about that, whatever style, whatever genre, you know, the time period that was written, and to try to bring some of those influences as much as possible into it as well.
We're speaking with Winston Choi, who is Associate Professor of Piano and Director of Piano Studies at Roosevelt University in Chicago, and a very busy and highly acclaimed concert pianist who comes to Kenosha to play with the Kenosha Symphony this weekend, performing George Gershwin's marvelous Concerto in F. How about the balance between teaching and performing? First of all, just kind of logistically keeping it straight, keeping it in balance, and also what those two experiences are to each other, teaching piano versus being a very active concert pianist. What do those ventures have to do with each other?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, many of my colleagues may choose one thing over the other at some point, or it's just simply the direction of their life, how it takes them. And I feel like I need to have both to have a certain kind of balance within my life. And that kind of balance is sometimes truly impossible if I try to do everything all at once. So I like to think about my life having a certain kind of a swing. It's like a pendulum. It swings back and forth between certain stretches of my year, which are much more intense in terms of my performing than other times of the year. It's a little lighter, so I'm a little bit more focused on my teaching and able to offer more time and to be there for my students. And so I feel like if I have that kind of natural swing back and forth, it's quite ideal. And it doesn't always swing so smoothly because at times it's just too many things all at once. You have to kind of force it through. But in general, I think my energy for my teaching is really derived from my practice habits. You know, what it is that I'm working on, and my stage experience too. But even more so, it's my work on my own that then guides and informs my teaching. Hmm. At the same time, when I teach and I'm able to verbalize and perhaps crystallize some of my ideas, it's when I go practice, I feel like I'm much more efficient because I have these larger concepts which have been kind of baking within me, and it feels like there's less questioning or even wondering about how to achieve those results because I've been working at that in sometimes roundabout ways with my students, and it might be a completely different repertoire, of course, but still some of those concepts can be very applicable to whatever it is that I'm playing. So I feel like it allows me to hit the ground running much more.
Hmm, I like that. By the way, you know, if we were to take a look at the scores of some of the really modern music that you perform. I mean, I think even someone who's not a musician, a trained musician at all, could probably look at a score and realize, oh my gosh, this is mind-blowingly, back-breakingly complicated, difficult music versus something that by a more standard composer of centuries ago that might also be difficult, but in a really, really different way. To what do you attribute your, in a sense, comfort level, your level of excellence with some of these really modern scores that can be so incredibly intimidating for an otherwise fully capable musician? I mean, what does it take in order to be able to confront this kind of music as successfully as you do?
Sure, yeah. Thank you for that question. Well, I think what it really comes down to is one's curiosity. If I'm curious about something and it generally awakens something within me that feels motivated and I feel pulled towards it, then the difficulties are worthwhile obstacles to fight through. And sometimes those difficulties almost find a way to just be absorbed within my work. There's not such a focus on how difficult it is. It's a part of the process of learning and working and learning a new language, so to speak. Occasionally, I come across something that's difficult and it doesn't pull me in. And let's say if I don't have the choice as to the repertoire, I've agreed to play something or I've been asked to play something where it's more out of professional obligation rather than my own choice to do so, I still have to find a way in those moments to find what it is about that piece that sparked somebody else or sparked the composer. And if I can identify with that, sometimes that's a way in for me, even if it's not initial. If it's not so-called love at first sight, I can still grow to become best friends with it. And I feel like any piece that I perform, you know, in the moment, I want to feel like it's what I live and dream of, and I'm living within that world. And so I think some of those difficulties are minimized with a certain psychological approach of embrace And then, of course, with time, you kind of spend more, you find more strategies for dealing with some of these difficulties, whether it's rhythmic or really thick textures, that sort of thing. I think it's, again, a bit of a continuum. You know, it's building upon work that I've done before. And occasionally I find a score that I've never, which has certain kinds of writing or techniques that I've never delved into before in my life, and it's a first experience. Those are in some ways very refreshing because I'm doing something I've never done before, and it can help me grow.
Well, this weekend you are playing Gershwin's Concerto in F, and although it's not nearly so well known as American in Paris or Rhapsody in Blue with more with flashier titles, I think most people would agree that the Concerto in F is the real true masterpiece among the extended works of Gershwin, and I should think it's probably a great pleasure to play. I understand that someone had to drop out, and Bob Hasty went looking for just the right person to step in, and there you are, apparently eager for the opportunity to play what I'm sure is an old favorite for you. Tell us about your relationship with the Gershwin Concerto in F.
Sure. I played it, I think, for the first time probably about 15 years ago, and then played it again a few years after that. And I think this is my third time playing it. And it's a piece that, unlike the Rhapsody in Blue, I didn't grow up with this concerto in my ear. I had heard it, I think, but it wasn't like all those themes were brought out a certain kind of nostalgia. And because, so maybe it hasn't quite captured the public in the way that Rhapsody in Blue has, simply because of, you know, a direct comparison between the two. There's slightly more so-called catchy tunes in Rhapsody in Blue. But I feel like the concerto has even more compositional richness to it. It's so well written. The way he intertwines various themes together and brings them back, changing their context, and it's rhythmically it's a blast to play. It's really a whirlwind, kind of a tour de force in combining all sorts of course jazz idioms, but also a lot. You can find a lot that is similar, perhaps, to some of Ravel's writing from his Ravel Concerto. And it's, classically, I think the way it's developed, the way there are certain traditions, but also the way that it's thematically linked together, I think it's a very cohesive work as well. So perhaps one of the most cohesive, and from a compositional standpoint, one of the the real pillars among his compositions.
Hmm. Very well put. I love that idea of it being cohesive and wonderfully crafted, and yet also so much fun, so energetic, and just a brilliant testament to Gershwin's genius. And of course, we are so excited to have you on the stage of Reuther High School Auditorium, playing it with the Kenosha Symphony and Maestro Bob Hasty, who I know is tremendously excited at the opportunity to be collaborating with you once again. Real quick, Winston Choi, you and your wife also head up something called the Unity Chamber Music Series. Tell our listeners what that is.
Yes, we lived for quite a few years in Oak Park, Illinois, and that happens to be the site of Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple, which is a stunning building. And it's really an architectural marvel, and it went through a major restoration project several years ago. And when it then reopened to the public, it just happened to be that we were in the right place at the right time, talking to somebody about our desires to bring music to that particular community in Oak Park, which is wonderful, and it has its own art scene, but not a centralized chamber music series, and everything just kind of fell into place. They were looking to do something at the Unity Temple to bring people back into such an amazing site. It's an acoustical and visual marvel, and we now have 4 to 6 concerts there a year, and it's something that we're very passionate about.
Marvelous. Encourage people to Google the Unity Chamber Music Series to find out more about that. And in the meantime, we want to remind people about Saturday night's concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, which features an array of wonderful American works, including Gershwin's Concerto in F. And playing it will be Winston Choi. Professor Choi, thank you so much for making time in your schedule for this conversation. It was great to talk with you, and I know many people are excited to see and hear you Saturday night with the Kenosha Symphony.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm delighted to be playing with the orchestra. Looking so much, again, to play with and work with Maestro Bob Hasty and sharing this fantastic music with your audience.
And here are the closing measures of Gershwin's magnificent piano concerto in F major. Gershwin's Piano Concerto in F Major. And for more information about Saturday night's concert of the Kenosha Symphony, you can go to their website, kenoshasymphony.org. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part three. And to finish out today's morning show, the Friday Morning Show, I'm connecting with Rachel Swartz, who is assistant professor of theater and coordinator of musical theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. They are doing a very important and interesting play this weekend. It's called Indecent by Paula Vogel, written back in 2015. In a sense, I was going to say a play within a play, or maybe a play about a play, another monumentally significant play. And a really intriguing story behind it. So first of all, Rachel Swartz, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you for having me again, Greg.
So Paula Vogel's Indecent is a play about another play called God of Vengeance that dates all the way back to the 1920s. Interesting that a play about a play from so many years ago could be, in some respects at least, tremendously relevant. Explain the background of Paula Vogel's play, Indecent, and be sure to include the reason why it has this title.
Absolutely. So Indecent by Paula Vogel, actually the play God of Vengeance was written in either 1906 or 1908. I'm slightly off on my dates off the top of my head, but came to Broadway in 1923, was written by Yiddish playwright Sholem Asch of Poland. The piece played heavily across Europe and talked predominantly about the struggles of an impoverished Jewish community and the shortfallings of humankind, really. But additionally, in 1923, the piece came to Broadway itself, moving from Uptown, having played in the Provincetown Playhouse, then into Broadway, where the cast and producers were arrested for obscenity as the play featured the first same-sex kiss on Broadway. Queer love is certainly a part of that that historical narrative that Asch wrote in the early 1900s. then Indecent itself is the story of the people that spent their lives telling this story, and some of whom gave their lives in order to tell this story. So we witness within this piece the entirety of the journey of the play's, from the play's first reading at a salon to its Berlin transfer, to its first Yiddish premiere off-Broadway, to the transfer to Broadway, and then the fate that befell those people, all the way up to Osh's own. He was called to the House of Un-American Committees in the 1950s, which led to him leaving our country at the end. And he has a tremendous line of, I'm paraphrasing here, but theater is, or is for those who have the privilege to care about the people that they live or feel that they'll be allowed to live in a place which they care about. And that, it's just so remarkable. It's a piece about assimilation and the struggles of immigration, it speaks tremendously about violence against women, about queer themes, and about Jewish culture and connection, and how that has shifted and shaped through time. So it's a big piece to be packed into an hour and 42 minutes, to be quite frank.
So how much of Sholem Asch's play, God of Vengeance, how much of it do we actually experience in the context of this newer play, Indecent? I mean, are there actual excerpts from the play, and are they extensive?
There are actual excerpts from the play. Some of them are rather brief. Some of them are full scenes extant from contemporary translations. And this all began, Rebecca Teichman, who directed it on Broadway, wrote her master's thesis on the 1923 obscenity trial, hence the title Indecent, as it were, as the cast and crew were charged with indecency. And her passion about God of Vengeance and how timely it was led Paula Vogel to co-collaborate and create this together with her, surrounding her incredible amount of research into the history and the arc of Asch's piece. But yes, we do see bits and pieces, including the most powerful and the most mentioned scene of the rain scene, the scene between Rivkala and Manka, which literary scholars have compared throughout time as being as potent as Romeo and Juliet's balcony scene between these two women.
Hmm. You mentioned before we went on the air, when you told me, reminded me that you're a coordinator of musical theater at Parkside, and I sort of laughingly said, of course, I don't think we're talking about musical theater with this particular play, Indecent, but you hastened then to add that, in fact, you are incorporating music into this production. Tell us what you're doing, and are you incorporating music in a way that the script specifically calls for, or is this something that you are choosing to bring into your production?
Sure. So the script itself comes with a full klezmer score.
Wow.
That is inherently a part of the storytelling there. It is a piece largely set to music. There are only six sung numbers throughout the piece, all either cultural pieces a la Breeder, some historical. There's a Dietrich number, Ich habe eine Koffer in Berlin, thinking back towards Andrew Sisters by Mir du Bist du Schön, those sort of pieces that that tie the piece to the times and the people are very much a part of it. And yes, the underscoring comes with a full klezmer band. So,
wow, very good. So how would you characterize kind of the emotional framework of this play? Do we find ourselves laughing, crying, some mix of the two? Is it a troubling play? Is it sort of all over the board? I mean,
I'm going to go with a little bit of all of the above. You know, part of my great joy about this piece is how much Jewish joy is a part of this, how much culture and celebration and passion and artistry is involved. So often when we tell honestly Jewish or queer narratives, we land ourselves in exceedingly dark places. And while unfortunately the Holocaust is a facet of these people's lives and stories, so much of the rest of this piece is human, and the human experience is so deeply vast and varied. So I think that audiences shouldn't be afraid to laugh in the parts that are meant for that to happen, and you know, to feel something when we're called to do so. I think the variety in this piece is what makes it so deep and strong.
Did any of your actors already know about Paula Vogel's Indecent before becoming part of this production, or is this, in a sense, a brand new adventure for them and their first exposure to this play?
It is their first exposure to this play. Most of our students were familiar with Vogel via her 88 Pulitzer Prize winner, How I Learned to Drive. But this piece, despite having a number of Tony nominations and was largely awarded outside of the Tonys as well, it seemed to sneak under the radar as far as pieces of theater that they were into. And it was incredible. Our first read-through, I watched some of the folks take the journey of, like, this is funny. Am I supposed to be laughing? This is funny. Oh, no, this is suddenly not funny. Are they going to be okay? Oh, gosh, they're not okay. You know, and it was really taking that journey with our actors was really informative of the journey of our audience. And I'm so deeply grateful for them in that, sharing that experience with me as I first read the piece back in, I think, 16. So it was a little bit in my bones by the time, you know, my colleagues were so graceful and grateful to entrust me with directing this one. Mm.
So when are performances and where, and how do people get ticket information?
Absolutely. So our performances are this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday and Saturday performances are both at 7 p.m. Our Sunday performance is a 2 o'clock matinee. Performances are in the Black Box in the Rita Talent Pickett Center here in Kenosha. I will say, due to COVID seating, which means every other seat is kept as a spacer, tickets are extremely limited for this production. So I would encourage that folks purchase tickets in advance rather than at the door, if at all possible. And tickets are available on the Rita website.
Very good. Rachel Schwartz is director of UW Parkside's production of Paula Vogel's Tony Award-winning play, Indecent, which is performed this weekend. Paula Vogel's play, something that really should not be missed. Rachel Schwartz, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to tell us about it. Best wishes to you and your cast and crew.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you again.
One further thing. Rachel Schwartz asked me to mention that the cast of this production of Paula Vogel's Indecent is going to be doing some fundraising for UNICEF on behalf of some of the people who have been so adversely affected by the events in Ukraine. So please keep that in mind if you're able to attend any of the performances coming up of Indecent at UW Parkside. Monday on The Morning Show, we're going to be previewing all of that's going on next week at the University of Wisconsin Parkside with its Jazz Week. We'll be speaking with trumpet instructor Russell Johnson. Also a preview of the next play at the Racine Theater Guild, Clue. We'll talk with director Doug Instanis and cast member Dan Martino. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And a reminder that you can subscribe to The Morning Show podcast